On our program, we like to have a good time. We also like to bring you interesting discussions. Of course, the news has been dominated in recent days about talk about health care reform, and that's some of what we'll get into with guests in the first hour of our program. His background lends him to be able to discuss this issue, I think, in a very informative fashion. Dr. Michael Lockshin is joining us in this first hour of our program. Dr. Lockshin is director of the Barbara Volker Center for Women and Rheumatic Disease at the Hospital for Special Surgery here in the city. He is the author, with the guest we've had on this program before, Alida Brill, of the book Dancing at the River's Edge, A Patient and Her Doctor Negotiate Life with Chronic Illness. The book is published by Schaffner Press, and he is joining us on our program. First of all, good morning to you, Dr. Lockshin.
And good morning to you, too.
It's nice to have you join us.
Glad to be here.
Beginning our discussion, I mentioned in introducing you that we had talked with Alida Brill on this program last year, featured a discussion about Dancing at the River's Edge. We'll get into talking about the book in a moment or two, but obviously, unless one has been on another planet, hidden under a rock, you're, I think, unable to avoid discussion about health care these days, everywhere you go.
Certainly when, in my life.
When you hear those three words, health care reform, realistically, what comes to your mind now?
Oh, I think this is a huge and wonderful change to the United States. I've been in this business for a long time and am increasingly appalled by the chaos that seems to be going forward year by year with different insurance rules, different people losing insurance, and so on. So that any change that makes the system more uniform and more fair is wonderful from my point of view.
And when we talk about this change or the series of changes, I mean, this is very complex, obviously, exactly what is taking place. In terms of the changes, because a number of things obviously roll out at various points over the next couple of years, what is it that most impresses you as being at the front line of those changes for the better?
Getting people who are losing health insurance access to health insurance. I guess the easiest way of saying that is that, as you know from the book and from my position, I deal mostly with people with chronic illness, and this is not chronic, progressively fatal illness. It's illness that people live with for their entire lives. And just watching people as a spouse loses a job or changes a job or an insurance company decides to change or let's say an employer decides to change a policy, I have people who's first are under care, then they have no access to care, then they have to go to different doctors. This sort of thing is just devastating to a person with a chronic illness, and this has been going on for a number of years. So being able to get rid of that is very important.
And when we talk about those who suffer with chronic illnesses, not everybody who is with us this morning may have heard the discussion with Alida Brill. How did the book Dancing at the River's Edge come about?
Oh, it came about by sort of a strange thing. Ms. Brill she describes herself as a social critic. She's has degrees in sociology and statistics, and had spent her professional life and doing studies on the way populations respond to different things. And she has a vocabulary that speaks to how physicians and doctors communicate. She's been my patient for a number of years. In the book, it's 30 years. And at a conversation at the table, because she's become a personal friend, she and I were discussing doctor-patient communication, and my wife had interrupted into that conversation and suggested this would be a topic of a book. We initially, neither of us really were very interested in that, but my wife kept pushing the idea, and it gradually grew on us. So we wrote the book as alternate chapters of what she saw at a given point in her life and what I saw at the same point, and what we didn't tell each other at that time as well. And in that book, we then end up discussing a lot of things, some of which have to do with access to care, some of which have to do with the way the community or the family or others, employers, respond to people with chronic illness, what a person with an illness feels when, in this case, she is not able to complete a task that she's planned, that sort of thing.
And when you talk about autoimmune diseases, how can you crystallize this in a way that the average person, especially those who are not affected by this, can understand? What's this like for somebody who's going through it?
Well, there are two things that I would answer. First, you can define autoimmune disease partly by knots. It's not cancer. It's not infection. It's inflammation that doesn't have a known cause, and generally it causes severe body pains, usually in the form of arthritis, and it causes fevers and oftentimes skin rashes, and then internal organs like the kidneys can be involved. But probably its most salient characteristic is that it's intermittent. It tends to come and go in what we call remissions and exacerbations, and that leaves a person quite uncertain about what the next day is going to bring. Some days they're perfectly healthy. They're often told, oh, you can't be ill, look how good you look, and then the next day they'll be incapacitated. And there are a group of diseases that fall into this category of autoimmune disease, probably about 10 that people might recognize, but they're all similar in that respect.
And when we talk about lupus, why is it that lupus is predominant among women?
I think there'd be a Nobel Prize in that, in the answer to that. People often thought that it was just the fact of estrogen versus androgen, but new research has suggested that it is not that. My personal bet is that it has, it potentially is an environmental cause of things that women and men do differently, but I don't have any proof to have that statement.
But lupus does affect men?
It does.
Children, older adults?
Yeah, typically lupus is from 15 to 35 in 90% are women, but it can be seen in infancy, and it can be seen in the elderly. Oftentimes, or in most populations, blacks are about four times more susceptible than are whites, and we don't have answers to any of those questions.
It's got to be frustrating.
It is, but it also gives lots and lots of opportunity for new ideas.
And where is the leading research in this being done?
Oh, I'd like to think that it's at our hospital, there are lots of really elegant work being done throughout the United States and throughout Europe and Asia.
This idea of the patient-doctor relationship, obviously this gets an awful lot of focus, and there's been a good deal of focus on this in aspects of discussions about the healthcare reform. The relationship that developed between you and Alida Brill, I mean, many listening to our discussion today, I'm assuming, would consider that to be unusual. How was it that you became friends?
Well, first of all, I would contradict that statement and say that it's not unusual. What's unusual in this particular instance is her articulateness and her ability to explain what's happening in our relationship. To a degree that can be expressed in a book. But over years, physicians and patients just get to know one another if there's any sort of communication at all. And I think it's really important that they each recognize there are things that are not said, and one can judge the, like any friendship, you can judge what might be good to say and what might not be good to say. There are times when patients know full well that I'm not giving them really dire aspects of their prognosis, though I can see it from clues in their illness. There are other times when patients simply don't want to share with me problems with their families or other things that they believe are their own personal sorts of things. And this happens pretty much in any long-term patient-physician relationship, and it affects the way in which people are treated as well, because you end up, at least I as a physician, end up having to make different choices depending on what seems to be best for this particular person at this particular time. Not medically best, but emotionally and sociologically best.
We're talking on our program On the Fan this Sunday morning with Dr. Michael Lockshin. Dr. Lockshin is director of the Barbara Volker Center for Women and Rheumatic Disease at the Hospital for Special Surgery here in New York City. He's the author, along with Lita Brill, of Dancing at the River's Edge, A Patient and Her Doctor Negotiate Life with Chronic Illness, the book published by Schaffner Press. That title, where did that come from?
Well, it came from a poem that she wrote, and it comes up in the almost the next to last chapter in the book, where she's summarizing what it's like to live a life with chronic illness. And if you can bear with me a minute, I'll read the paragraph that it comes in. She wrote the poem that says, "Don't push the river, it flows by itself. It flows above us and beneath us, but in the middle, we dance in the moonlight at the river's edge." Then she goes on to say, "When I wrote the poem, I thought of the river as a metaphor for relationships. It was a poem about love's price and women's endurance. It was not a poem about chronic illness. Or was it? Reading it again, I wonder whether that river represented then, as it surely does now, chronic disease itself." And the book, in walking through the various experiences that we had, it comes to a conclusion as we analyze the relationships, that it's the partnership of physician and patient that is necessary over this long, long period of time, in this case 30 years of managing illness.
The idea of that partnership between physician and patient in an age of managed care, how has that impacted what you've been able to do?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I sometimes speak about what I refer to as the evidence against evidence-based medicine. And what I mean by that is that there are rules that are set up. This is the best thing to do. Just if you have X, you do Y, that sort of thing. But the rules are generally set up for very short-term acute illness. If you have a heart attack, this is what you do in the first couple of minutes. This is what you do in the next several hours. And they don't take into account that things change over time, that patients have decisions that they have to make, for instance, and those decisions don't necessarily fit what the rules might say. One of the themes of the book, and I guess this is the best way of answering your question, has to do with the different ways of measuring time. You can measure time in an instant. That's if you have a heart attack, you have a seizure, you collapse and die, that sort of thing. You can measure it in what I refer to as clock time, that evolves over hours or days, calendar time, which evolves over a month, and then there is generational time. We actually use a Maya calendar as a metaphor for this, where you're doing something today, but the effects of what you're doing may take place 10 or 20 years from now. And in dealing with chronic illness, we have to make all those choices, and that patient has to express his or her own assessment of those choices. So when you talk about evidence-based medicine, this is where managed care comes in, and people say this, you do X, Y, Z in this sequence, in this or time frame, it doesn't really work when you're making long-term plans and when you're inviting the patient to help you make those choices.
Now, there are many people, as you well know, in this country who are in opposition to the healthcare reform plan or aspects of it. I mean, this has literally dominated the airwaves in some places. You know, there are people talking about the idea of trying to repeal parts of this, et cetera. Two-part question for you. First of all, do you understand their sentiments? And then the second part of that is, what about this claim? And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this, so I'm going to ask it right now, that some people make that this is simply a step towards socialized medicine.
Well, I guess for the first question, intellectually I understand the argument, but you asked, do I understand it? And the answer is no. And part of that's because I'm on the front lines, and I see the damage that occurs when there are not safety nets for people. No one asks to become ill. Clearly there are people who, by substance abuse or by reckless living and so on, are responsible for their own illness. But most of the people that I see are just like everybody else, or like you and me, and suddenly something afflicts them, and they have had no choice in the matter whatsoever. I deal often with very young people, so a 20-year-old comes in ill and her life is basically changed from one day to the next with no fault on her part. And these people are not protected in any way. If they have lots of money, they can usually manage somewhere around it. But if they don't have money, they don't have insurance and so on, they are very, very vulnerable. So that's why I don't understand why people don't want to help protect that person who could be you or me. With regard to the issue of socialized medicine, I guess my response would be, are you ready to give up Medicare? Are you ready to give up your Social Security? Do you want government to do nothing for you whatsoever? And most people who make the arguments vehemently would not give up their Medicare, would not give up Social Security, which are also government programs that were originally devised to protect the vulnerable. Now, I've been around long enough that I was in medical school and in house staff training when Medicare first came in.
Mm-hmm.
When before Medicare, I'd see people make the progress from the elegant teaching hospitals. They'd go, first they'd be private patients, then they'd be transferred down to the clinic service, then they'd be transferred down to the city hospitals like Bellevue as charity cases, having sold everything they had, having been divorced because they could get onto welfare or get charity more easily. They didn't want to bankrupt their families. It was a completely miserable time. Then Medicare came in, and it saved the elderly from the indignities of just losing everything they had because of the occurrence of an illness. And I sort of see this program as doing the same thing for a larger segment of the population. Even if you raise the issue of socialized medical care, that doesn't terrify me particularly. I've had the advantage in my life of visiting lots of countries, and particularly the European countries. Holland has a perfectly wonderful medical care system. Sweden has a perfectly wonderful medical care system. France is quite good. Germany is quite good. England is good. And I've been even to the Canadians. When you talk to the Canadians, they're not terribly unhappy about what's happening, and they all have systems that are much easier to work in than ours.
But don't you have to, I mean, what part of the criticism with Canada's system, as I've heard, is that you also, as a patient, have extremely long waits to see a doctor.
It depends on what the issue is, and that happens. But the wait is infinite in the United States for 40 million people right now, because they have no access at all. So you end up making the trade-off. Will it be a bit more inconvenient for non-emergent things in that sort of system for everybody, or is it worse to have 40 million people with no access to medical care at all? And I don't buy the issue of, oh, you can always go to an emergency room, partly because, number one, the emergency room is still a tax. Everybody pays for it because the hospitals would go under if they didn't get reimbursed for all the care that's given in emergency rooms. And the second is emergency rooms are basically the finger in the dike for individual people. You can never get sustained care. You can never get a plan of action that will go on forever. All you do is get an immediate problem like pain or bleeding or something taken care of.
But they are getting care, though.
It's stopgap care. And if that's acceptable to you, then I would posit that all the kids who are in skiing accidents, or in car crashes or motorcycle accidents, or even get drunk and get injured, should not get that care if they don't have insurance. I mean, that's the logical outcome of saying that we're not going to pay through it through the taxes that support the emergency rooms and the city hospitals.
Well, in a couple of years' time, when everything has rolled out with this plan, do you anticipate, because I've heard this speculation from a medical doctor, actually in another state, made the statement this week to someone I know.
I'm sorry.
He made the statement to somebody that I know. His statement was that he expects to see many of his colleagues retire from the profession as a result of the changes that are taking place. I mean, is that a realistic expectation?
Yes, but I see also a lot more people coming into it, into the profession. One of the things that isn't spoken about very much these days is the disparity in reimbursement to physicians. And certainly physicians talk about it a lot. But someone who's a primary care physician, someone in even a profession like mine, is not terribly highly paid compared to, say, some of the surgical specialties. Some of the specialties that do a lot of procedures like cardiology or gastroenterology. And I know generally people at the higher end of the reimbursement chain, that is the physicians and surgeons, have been speaking like that because they likely will have cuts in their reimbursement, or at least there'll at least be a leveling of the pay to doctors for different activities that they do. But the other side of that is that you should see the young students coming up. Many of them are very idealistic. Many of them are very willing to work, for instance, in salaried positions, which are, it basically guarantee them incomes, but and don't make them generate it by trying to turn over more and more patients. So I suspect there will be retirements, but I suspect there will be a lot more people coming in that'll replace the ones who are leaving, and I'm not terribly worried about that.
We're in discussion with Dr. Michael Lockshin on our program. Dr. Lockshin is director of the Barbara Volker Center for Women and Rheumatic Disease at the Hospital for Special Surgery here in the city. Author, along with Alida Brill, of Dancing at the River's Edge, A Patient and Her Doctor Negotiate Life with Chronic Illness, the book published by Schaffner Press, And Dr. Lochin has been with us for this hour of our program. I mentioned before we paused for our sports update and messages that if you want to, you can join our discussion. We've touched upon healthcare reform, talked a little bit about the book as well. If you have a thought or comment, you want to jump in, you can do it toll-free at 877-337-6666 here at The Fan. Now, before we get to the phones, I posed a question to you, Dr. Lochin, and this was something that perhaps some of the people who are listening to us may have expected me to do at the beginning of our discussion, but sometimes I like to throw the listeners a curveball, too. Why did you go into medicine and go into the specific area of medicine that you did?
Well, why I went into medicine, that was more or less foreordained. As a very young child, I was interested in biology and science, and there's a controlled experiment there because I'm an identical twin, and my brother was also interested in biology and science, and as we grew, we were looking at careers that would allow us to pursue those interests. He became a PhD scientist, and I became a physician, and that just had to do with our individual personalities and our interest in how we wanted to apply that type of training. With regard to rheumatology, that grew on me in medical school. I initially wasn't interested at all in the idea of dealing with chronic illness, but it was partly the patients that I was working with and partly the science that I saw in the field, and very specifically the fact that I recognized that there was so little known about this field and it was a burgeoning field that led me into this. A specific experience with patients in medical school that led me into rheumatology.
Dr. Lochin, what I've mentioned we will do in the course of our discussion is also to take some calls from some of the people listening to us. You've raised a number of different points that I think will be interesting. There are also probably going to be some people who will want to get in a thought or two about this idea of people who are dealing with chronic pain and some of the issues that you have raised as well in our discussion. Our number here at The Fan is 877-337-6666. And let's see if we can start here with the phone. Who's been holding the longest here? We'll go to Rich in Long Beach. Rich, good morning. Welcome to The Fan.
Oh, good morning. Great show. A couple of comments, a couple of questions quickly, I hope. I was treated for cancer about 2005. 2 years later, hepatitis C, and consequently, my employment went down. I couldn't afford the insurance. And I'm at the point now where I've just gotten back to work, but I lost my insurance. I haven't even been able to go and get blood taken because of the cost and so on. I'm noticing my gastroenterologist, for one, does not even take insurance. He wants cash. Now, is this going to be something that's going to happen throughout the medical industry where doctors are going to just refuse the insurance, whatever it is, whatever you have, and just go to a cash system? It's pretty scary, and I just want to say something else with the health reform. Is that I think 40 million people have taken a deep breath and for once and for many years probably felt like they were a little bit secure in their health issues.
Okay, I'm going to let Dr. Lochin address your comments on the air. Thank you for your call and your patience on the phone. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Rich tells us the story that I've been living with my entire life is people who have something happen to them, and then their entire world falls apart, not only because of the illness, but also because every financial support that they thought they had for the illness disappears. And he asked then, if I understood the question correctly, about doctors refusing to accept the insurance. That will happen, but there will be other doctors who will accept it. And what I anticipate happening, though I don't have any magic crystal ball to look at, is that there will be a period of adjustment as people get used to the newer system and the fact that everyone has insurance. In our own hospital, for instance, initially we had some problems with physicians not accepting insurance, but now our hospital has at least someone on staff who accepts pretty much every insurance, and so it's dealt with it in a responsible way to make sure that there are physicians available for every kind of insurance. I suspect most organizations are going to do that sort of thing to be responsible and to be able to accept patients, not necessarily individual physicians, but at least someone within that medical community.
The voice of Dr. Michael Lockshin, who is our guest in this hour of our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. Back to the phone, we go to Rockville Center on the island and say good morning to George. George, thanks for holding. Welcome to The Fan.
Yes, good morning. I have two questions and for the doctor, please, and then I'll hang up and listen to his comments.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to health reform, the one thing that I'm concerned about is I currently have health coverage, and it's sort of difficult to me. I'm a CPA, and I deal in basically with doctor groups. If you bring 30 to 40 million people into the system, what about the treatment of the people who currently are being treated? I don't see with the same amount of doctors, the same amount of infrastructure, how the people who currently have health insurance are going to get the same treatment. Seems impossible to me. And the other side of the ledger is some of the groups that I deal with are going to go, won't be able to afford the same services under the structure. And when the doctor said there's going to be a readjustment of payment, if I have a heart problem or a cancer problem, I want somebody who is not a general practitioner. I want a heart doctor. And I don't want that group being diminished because of this health bill, because I feel, again, my treatment's going to be adversely affected. I'm going to hang up and I'll listen to the doctor's comments. Thank you.
Thank you for your call this morning, George. Dr. Lockshin?
Yes, well, George asks two really important questions. Obviously, again, we're going to see how this plays out. The first question he asked was, when you suddenly add 30 million people to the healthcare rolls, will there be enough physicians to care for these people, and what will happen to the people who are already enrolled? And I guess my response will be, first of all, physicians have been rapidly moving to systems that allow assistants, the physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and things like that, that will allow them to expand practices and focus on the more important things. So things like simple colds or lacerations that need suturing or something like that may be handled by non-physicians, but say nurse practitioners. That's one way of handling the system. I don't think that people currently in the system are going to be squeezed a great deal. First of all, adding 30 million people doesn't say adding 30 million sick people. One of the problems of even addressing the issue of healthcare in the United States is that most people are well most of the time, and so they think everything is just fine for them because they don't have to use the system. It's only when they actually have to use it that it becomes a problem. And we'll see, but we'll either have additional assistance or we'll start creating more physicians. There will be an adjustment, but I don't see that it's going to be a disastrous one. With regard to the people who have really good healthcare plans, and George was worried that they will lose some of the things that they have, what I believe he's talking about is the Cadillac-type plans. And I think that most people who are willing to pay the extra premiums for the extra services will still have them. I don't really see that he brought up the question of having a heart problem and not being able to get to a cardiologist. I don't really see that happening. But I think I don't even see that the primary care physician is going to be the gatekeeper to prevent people from going to specialists when it's needed. The issue will be more being clear that it is needed. I guess from my point of view, what I often see, and this happens pretty much every week in my office, is some people who have seen every person who does what I do in town. I saw, for instance, a patient last week who I was the fifth rheumatologist she saw. Some of those things are unnecessary, and I guess if there are savings to be made or adjustments, some of the multiple consultations and overuse of MRI and CAT scanning and things like that will be the way in which the restrictions will come if they do come.
But who determines whether those things are unnecessary?
That's correct.
I mean, that's the $64,000 question here.
Right, and maybe Americans in general will continue to want everything that they can get at any cost, at any time, and if so, the costs will be higher. If there are authorities, whether it be the physician or whether it be someone higher, that says, no, that's enough, you have to stop it, we'll end up having to make that decision. Don't think that that decision isn't being made right now. Depending on your insurance, there are many circumstances that I deal with every day where someone says, you can't do this test, you can't send to this consultant because the insurance company has said that you can't do that. So it isn't as though everyone can go anywhere and get any test right now. There's a huge amount of restriction that's placed on people, some more than others. And what I look to is a greater fairness to the system and a greater availability to everyone of the advantages that some have.
The voice of Dr. Michael Lockshin, our guest in this first hour of our program this Sunday morning. He, along with Alida Brill, put together the book Dancing at the River's Edge, A Patient and Her Doctor Negotiate Life with Chronic Illness, the book and hardcover published by Schaffner Press. Dr. Lockshin, as I mentioned in our discussion, also is the director of the Barbara Volker Center for Women and Rheumatic Disease at the Hospital for Special Surgery here in the city. He has an awful lot to share, has shared an awful lot with us in this discussion. Very quickly here, we've got actually less than a minute left. With the center's work, is there a way to, and I didn't ask you this earlier, I should have, in maybe a 30-second answer for us, give us the focus, the real mission of the center and its work?
It has to do with the special problems that women with rheumatic diseases have, and that, in effect, that's what the whole book is about. It's the social and the reproductive and the emotional and the medical issues that chronic illness imposes, particularly on women.
Dr. Lockshin, thank you for joining us on our program, being kind with your time.
Thank you. It's been a terrific morning.